Now back to the classroom and the gallery. Do modern professors and artists accept and project the primacy of consciousness? Is that notion also their essence and root conviction? For a moment, I'm going to surprise you, because in a sense, my answer is no. Leaving aside the schizophrenics among them, and there's quite a surprising number, but leaving them aside, the modernist does not believe that bed sheets emanate from his eyes or that his mood determines the weather. In some terms, the modernist, like all non-psychotics, distinguishes between existence, which is independent of him, and his mind, whose task, he knows, is to perceive, not to create reality. Insofar as he is sane, the modernist has to recognize the primacy of existence, because only that recognition keeps anybody sane. But now look at the other side of the modernist picture. The modernist, let us say, is sane, but he is sane in spite of himself, in spite of his professed philosophy and art. I say this because the essence of modernism as a cultural orientation is pure primacy of consciousness. The primacy of consciousness is not only the explicit lesson modern philosophers teach their classes. It is the very universe which modern writers and artists recreate in their works. And let us be clear on this point. Normal men, including normal non-modern artists, may be said to desire power, in a sense. They want the power to understand reality and thereby to achieve their values in the world through appropriate rational action. But modern artworks reflect their creator's desire for an utterly different kind of, quote, power. These men want the power to control reality itself. What else is the meaning of an artwork that flouts all sense, reduces physical objects to chaos, embraces at the same time deliberately contradictory perspectives, and gloats over the corpse of reality? All of it simultaneously broadcasts and tries to actualize a single principle, the metaphysical power of whim, the power of the whim worshiper to create or destroy any reality he wishes any time he feels like it. What the modern artist recreates and publishes between covers or hangs in a frame for us to fawn over is the very same universe that the schizophrenic takes seriously, at least seriously enough to get put into a hospital for. Now, the modernist has his own version of a split mind. There is his daily, prosaic, primacy of existence routine, and there is his cherished philosophy and art at war with it. Somehow, and don't ask me how, these people switch the one orientation off or part off and the other on or part on as the spirit moves them. So there is some difference in the way these two groups, modernists and schizophrenics, hold their basic premise. There is some difference in the intensity or consistency of their primacy of consciousness. But the difference is not absolute, and to be honest, it is not very clear to me. Part of the reason for my unclarity is that the schizophrenic also switches premises. Some of the time, he too knows somehow that the primacy of consciousness is wrong. In a sense, he knows it even as he announces it, which is one explanation of the fact that he rarely tries to act on his metaphysical delusions, whereas delusions characteristic of other psychotics, they do try to act on. The other part of the reason for my unclarity here is that the modern artist is not a mere poseur or hypocrite, preaching one philosophy while living by another. On the contrary, in some sense, and here I'm leaving aside the many out charlatans among them, but in some sense, the modernists are sincere. Much of the time, they really believe in and live by the primacy of consciousness. Both their works and their moans convince me that they do hate reality. They do desperately desire to transcend and defeat it, and they do suffer the unavoidable affective result of this attitude. Like the schizophrenic, and for the same basic reason, the modernist feels one essential emotion, which he tells us insistently in his novels, his paintings, and his cocktail parties. He feels terror, the fear of nothingness, the imminence of the apocalypse. For further details, read Schopenhauer, or Kierkegaard, or Kafka. And then try to figure out who is more miserable, the gibbering psychotic or the modern intellectual. The title of Dr. Sass's book, I've given you just a hint, is justified. There is an eerie likeness between madness and modernism. Schizophrenia, in his words, is, quote, a simulacrum of the modern world in the most private recesses of the soul, unquote. Now let us turn to etiology. Why? What root cause is at work here, turning Western culture into a specific form of madness? Well, since we are dealing with the primacy of consciousness, in other words, with an issue of fundamental philosophic orientation, we must seek the root cause in the field of philosophy. Which philosopher? I'll give you a hint. Which German philosopher, 200 years ago, put an end to the rule of the primacy of existence in the West and established in its place a two-century-long rule of the primacy of consciousness? By now, everyone here must know the answer, because I have denounced this man for this exact reason in many speeches from this very forum. I am happy to say that at last Ayn Rand and I are not alone on this point. Although Dr. Sass's estimate of him differs from mine, Dr. Sass names the same man I do as the root cause of modern developments. We both name Immanuel Kant, the thinker who convinced the West that reality is unknowable, and all we can know is a phenomenal world which we create by our own subjective mental structures. Kant is widely acknowledged to be the father of all subsequent philosophy, from Fichte, Hegel, and Marx on down to today's shambles. Kant is also the source of the West's distinctively modernist culture, from literature and art to education and manners. And for details, I refer you to my book, The Ominous Parallels, which works out that thesis at length. But what is most surprising to me in this context is that Kant, it seems, also has a connection to the very disease of schizophrenia itself. Now, this last point is controversial. It is at best a likely hypothesis, but I can't resist mentioning it in passing. According to Dr. Sass, there is very little evidence of schizophrenia having occurred in the ancient or medieval periods, or in primitive or non-Western areas of the globe to this day, although there is evidence of other psychoses in all these times and places. Schizophrenia, he thinks, appears primarily in the developed West, and not until, and now I'm going to quote from him, it appears not until, quote, the end of the 18th century or the beginning of the 19th. Schizophrenia's emergence coincided with the birth of the modern epistemology identified with the Kantian revolution at the turn of the 19th century, unquote. Now, in other words, he's saying schizophrenia requires a Kantian culture in which to flourish. It requires a society in which the primacy of consciousness is like an axiom, taken for granted everywhere. And at one point, Sass goes so far as to write, quote, it is, in fact, almost as if schizophrenics were living out some form of transcendental idealism, unquote. That's a technical term for Kant's philosophy. And indeed, Sass even mentions one of his patients, Martin. This blew me away. Martin stated that, quote, reading Kant was a very calming experience for me. I continue from Martin. Kant has been where I am going. And this provided me with security, the feeling that it was okay to feel what I was feeling. Unquote. I mean, you can't say anything after that. Now, I am not a psychiatrist. I obviously can't discuss this theory of schizophrenia any further. If it's true, it's merely one more proof of the title that one contemporary of Kant's, the philosopher Jacobi, bestowed on him. He called Kant the all-destroyer. Now remember that Kant's power to destroy flowed from a single point, which Kant placed at the heart of our society. His all-out attack on reason, his claim that reason is impotent to know reality. Given this fact, what do you think would be the most mistaken claim an interpreter at this point could make? I doubt that you have the imagination to guess it. I didn't. So I will merely inform you here of Dr. Sass's interpretation of the phenomena he so eloquently describes in his book. The deepest common denominator between schizophrenia and modern culture, he says, the basic error they both commit is they seek too much self-awareness, too much consciousness, too much reason. The two groups, he writes, quote, may be actually products of a kind of hyper-rationality, forms of irrationality generated by rationality itself, unquote. Schizophrenia and modern culture, he suggests at one point, illustrate for us, quote, the dangers in the enshrining of reason, unquote. I have neither the time nor the stomach to discuss this aberration of Dr. Sass, which is as outlandish as any schizophrenic symptom in his book. The explanation, of course, is that Sass, too, is a Kantian. I will simply tell you the difference between Dr. Sass and me on the present topic. He concludes from the parallels he presents that schizophrenics should be more highly respected, that they are more rational than we think. I conclude the opposite. Not that schizophrenics are better than we know, but the 20th century writers and artists are much, much worse. Not that schizophrenics are too enamored of reason, but that modern culture, judged by the DSM-3R, in other words, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, third edition revised, in other words, modern culture, judged by official technical definition, is pure insanity. A rhetorical question. How long do you think an industrial civilization can survive this kind of cultural pandemic? It's rhetorical because the answer is self-evident. What is the solution? We need to define and spread the answer to Kant. The answer involves an entire philosophy, but it starts with a single principle. What is that starting point? Let me quote some brief fragments here from a recovered schizophrenic writing about her emergence from madness. Quote, instead of infinite space, unreal, where everything was cut off, I saw reality, marvelous reality for the first time. The people whom I encountered were no longer phantoms, gesticulating without meaning. They were men and women with their own individual characteristics. It was the same with things. They were useful things, having sense, capable of giving pleasure. Here was an automobile to take me places, cushions I could rest on. With the astonishment that one views a miracle, I devoured with my eyes everything that happened. This is it, I kept repeating, and I was actually saying, this is it, reality, unquote. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the basic answer to schizophrenia, to modern culture, and to Immanuel Kant. This is it, reality. Now you know why Ayn Rand began objectivism with the principle that existence exists. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Peikoff, for sharing your views with us tonight. Now, as you know, this is the time we give members of the audience an opportunity to present questions to you, to elaborate on your views. Since the program is being taped for cablecast, I would appreciate it if anybody who has a question would come to either one of the two microphones in the front of the two aisles, and I will call upon you. So if anyone has a question, we'd be pleased to have Dr. Peikoff respond. Yes, sir.
Dr. Peikoff, what, in your view, are some of the greatest, or your personal favorite, works of art in history?
Well, that's a pretty easy question, considering what you could have asked. Do I have to repeat that question?
No.
Some of the greatest favorites of mine in art history takes in a tremendous territory. In literature, my favorites are the Romantics, the 19th century Romantics, Hugo, Dostoevsky. I love, as playwrights, Rostand. Any playwrights that present man as a being of stature, confronting a world with he has a purpose, a goal, he fights against obstacles, against conflicts, and either wins or loses, but it's an ennobling experience to watch him, follow him. I gave a course of what I consider the greatest plays in history, and they all had that common denominator, whether it was Montaigne or Sophocles, even Shakespeare, in many cases. Now, jumping from that, I like a great deal of romantic music, some of the Baroque music. My favorite of all arts, believe it or not, is sculpture. And my favorite, it should be obvious from my writings and speeches in that field, is Michelangelo. If I had nothing else to do, I would just shuttle between Paris and Florence and just sit at the feet of those statues perennially. I don't know how else even to begin answering. That's a start.
Thank you.
Yes, Dr. Peikoff, where does one draw the line with modern art or modern philosophy, such as like M.C. Escher with his art? It was realistic, but yet at the same time modern. Where can you draw the line?
Well, when do I call something modern?
Yeah.
Well, partly it's the time frame in which it exists, and partly it's the attributes of the thing, to what extent it coheres with the rest of the works that belong in that period. It's not exclusively a time thing, because you could do a completely representational work today, and that would not make it modernistic. Take Impressionism as an example. Impressionism leads toward modern art, but in itself it is still entirely representational. There's a blurring of the edges that you can see is a line moving from what the earlier approach was till you get complete non-representational works. I don't think you can place an exact line. As my definition in terms of painting is, as long as it is discernible objects as man perceives them. The crucial thing is it has to be in accordance with man's means of perception. But if you have, for instance, wristwatches melting, you know, and floating through empty space in defiance of gravity, etc., to say nothing of just dots and smears, that becomes modernistic at that point.
Dr. Peikoff, it has been described that there was a split in our country, a split between the intellectuals and, let's say, the average person, that most people don't believe this garbage. Does that split still exist in our society? You described in your book, The Ominous Parallels, how it did not exist in Germany. Does it still exist today? To what extent is it closing?
Well, the split that you refer to certainly exists, but in this particular issue in regard to modern art is much, much broader than simply the United States. There is no people in any country of the entire world that buys modern art or modern culture. Not any. This is entirely an intellectual phenomenon put over by intellectuals with no popular appeal. The only way that they're able to survive at all financially is through government handouts and subsidies, which is why they're so keen on government money. And also by the fact that, if you'll notice, they continuously combine modernist stuff with traditional stuff. So you'll go to a ballet, for instance, and part of it will be a classical ballet, and the other part of it will be their smearing their bodies and rolling over upside down and the things that they do, which they call modernist dance. When they only put on that kind of spectacle, just as if they only put on the modern screechings or John Cage, etc., they get no audience. They simply can't survive. And that is not only in the United States. No people anywhere buy this phenomenon. It's entirely sustained by an intellectual elite and government money. It would be impossible in a free society, and it's impossible ever to have a public for that kind of work. So the split that I was talking about definitely exists on a much broader scale on this issue.
Dr. Peacock, I was wondering, with regards to your reference about car chases in movies, I'm speaking about car chases in movies being the predominant theme.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to one movie that I think won't have any car chases, and I was wondering if you had any information about the production of the movie Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah, let me just clarify. I will get to the issue of Atlas Shrugged, but I didn't mean to suggest by that any time one character chases another, that is anti-value. That's obviously not the case. If there were something important at stake and the person chasing the other was a hero or a villain and there was some goal to be achieved and the purpose of the chase was the result, then of course a chase could be exciting. I was talking about chases where they're concerned only with the technical direction of, you know, all of the wild special effects and the frenzy, etc. And they couldn't care less who is chasing who or why they're doing any chasing or what's going to be the result of the chase. There's no story. There's just somebody had the idea, let's go on for 20 minutes now with a bizarre chase with Stallone flying through space for whatever he's after this time. Now, as far as the Atlas Shrugged movie, it's at the stage now where a company has been formed. And they are trying to raise independent financing. A director and a producer have been picked. And the question is whether they're going to be able to raise the financing to do it or not. And it's impossible for me to predict at this time whether they're going to succeed or not. They're making manful and valiant attempts, and they're having some success. It's just too early to say. If they can raise the money, then I have the belief and the hope that they'll be able to produce a worthwhile movie of Atlas Shrugged. And that's a big statement to make in today's world.
Dr. Peacock, my question is similar to that. What do you know about the remake of The Fountainhead?
The only thing I know about the remake of The Fountainhead, the only thing I know is that I have no rights over it. I don't control the property. When Miss Rand signed the movie rights, she was not yet in a position of fame where she could demand control over remakes. And consequently, she signed it away as a necessity of having the original movie made. And that was subsequently bought up by another company, and another company, I think, ended up being owned by Ted Turner, who has sold the rights, the option, to somebody else, whom I don't know. That's not exactly accurate. I had lunch with him, but I don't know him, and I have no input into the process, so I know nothing about that.
Thank you.
And don't blame me for it when it comes out.
Dr. Peacock, I have a more general question. What, in your opinion, is the role and value of cooperation in society, and what are, in your opinion, are the conditions for its success?
Well, that's certainly a big switch from the topic that we were doing. In a general way, cooperation, if you mean the relationship between two or more people, when they pursue a goal together by separating aspects of the task or by one doing one thing and one doing another, cooperation is absolutely essential to human survival, except on a desert island. There's no question of cooperation. Nature doesn't cooperate with you, and animals don't. And there it's just a matter of you take what you can, and if you can't get it, you die. But in a human society, people can achieve feats by joint action that would be impossible to any man by himself. So certainly, I want to correct any implication, if there was one, that you're asking me that question because I'm an individualist, and an individualist is somebody who opposes cooperation. It's not true at all. But what makes you an individualist also answers the second part of your question, which is, under what conditions is cooperation valuable? When it is voluntary, when it is non-coerced, when there is no initiation of force, when two people mutually agreed, each one, that he wishes to achieve a certain end and he's prepared to do so-and-so in exchange for the other person doing so-and-so. In other words, when you have a free society, when does cooperation, harmful if you call it cooperation, mutual working together, when it's under a whip, under a gun, or the way it's, the modern form of that right now is under a government, then you don't have cooperation anymore, you have extirpation of the mind. You have then masters and slaves, and you see that happening all over the world today. Now, I certainly don't want to change from art to medicine, but for instance, what President Clinton is suggesting in regard to medicine is the utter perversion of the proper cooperation, because his idea is to ensure to everyone in the country, to guarantee to everyone in the country medical care. How can you guarantee as a right medical care without at the same time owning the providers of the medical care? If they are free agents, you cannot guarantee their services to somebody else. It's physically, logically impossible. So inherent in guaranteeing medical care is taking over the body and, more important, the minds of the providers of that care, whether it's the pharmacists, the surgeons, the internists, whatever. And what does that practically consist of? It consists of massive details of bureaucratic statement of how they can and can't perform their function, what they must and mustn't do, what expenditures are and aren't permitted, what kind of procedures will and will not be allowed. And it means basically the government taking over the mind of the doctors. I'm giving you this as propaganda, but just as an example. You cannot have productive medicine under those circumstances. You cannot have doctors who are going to be anything better than postmen because you're having exactly the same conditions. And the result is going to be a disaster and a perfect example of the destruction of cooperation. It'll be joint effort, but it'll be joint effort of enslaved minds, and the result is going to be catastrophe. I just put that across the board. You'll see why I think that if you want cooperation, it can only be done under an individualist, free, capitalist society.
Dr. Peacock, do you believe that the issue of primacy of consciousness in a person exists the belief in primacy of consciousness exists on a continuum, and that schizophrenia would be the extreme, that in a given man it can be mixed. You could have certain issues or certain premises about which you believe that wishing makes it so, but that overall you're not that kind of person.
I believe there is a continuum, but I also believe that that is a question that is really not known. Because the complicated thing to me is that what I tried to indicate in the talk is that there is a sense in which nobody really believes it. I alluded to this in the talk. For instance, if you take a typical non-schizophrenic psychotic, like a manic depressive. And he will have the delusion, let us say, that he is going to become world famous. And his delusions will be a result of a sense of grandiosity. But then it will lead him to take a certain kind of action. He will, start buying up properties right and left he'll spend all of his money. Or he'll start litigating frantically, suing everyone if he thinks they're trying to persecute him, etc. There'll be a correlation between his delusion and his action. So you can say, in some sense, even though this man is crazy, he believes his delusion, and you can see it in his action. But the interesting thing about the schizophrenics, this lady, for instance, who believed that people emanate from her eyes and so on, they say these things. Now, they are not lying. They're not just putting on an act. But they don't believe it in the way that the manic depressive, for instance, believes his delusions. If you said to this lady, well, fine, says bed sheets are coming out of your eyes, you can sleep on the floor tonight and just emanate out the bedding that you need, she would just throw up her arms and say, that's ridiculous. The floor is hard. There's no attempt to turn those delusions into actual practice. You see what I mean? They will say to you, for instance, the world is full of poison. And at the same time, they say, pass the coffee. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a sense, therefore, in which the schizophrenics themselves, who are the extreme of the primacy of consciousness, don't believe it. And yet there's another sense in which they do believe it, because there's a reason that they're, in the condition that they're in. In the same way, there's a sense in which everybody that can cross the street believes in the primacy of existence. And on the other hand, there's a sense in which virtually nobody does, because in one form or another, you could take the most decent person and you will find, because of the cultural training and because of the centuries of Kant, some form of superstition or the belief in astrology or in some form of mysticism or some idea that if I wish it or if we all wish it, it's going to happen. So there's what psychologists have to do is map out in what way you can hold some beliefs inconsistently and yet with terrifying consequences. And you can do that in many different forms. That is a field that I'm almost thankful I'm not in. This was my one-time excursion into the field of psychiatry. And it was only this book, the only way I got to this topic, as I read the review in the New York Times. And I thought, what an idea, a psychiatrist, thinks that madness and modernism are the same. I'll have to read the book. And then I got hooked on it that way. But I am no authority on this field, and therefore I'm hesitant to say it's literally a continuum, because metaphysics is not the kind of thing that can be like... metaphysics is more like pregnancy. You have it or you don't. It doesn't... It come in degrees. And therefore it's a very complicated question to try to figure out how people combine opposite metaphysics. And that's why I said in the talk that I was unclear where you draw the line between these types of people, and I still am. So I don't even want to go so far as to say it's a continuum. It's a field to be explored.
I had a question to begin with, and then some remarks later, raised some comments, which I have a feeling that you're throwing too many things into one basket in order to substantiate the thesis. I wouldn't be very eloquent because I'm a technician in my application and mathematician by education, so I don't know enough perhaps. But you seem to have thrown into this basket of schizophrenia-oriented any kind of idealism. And just as a mathematician, we work in the realm of the mind, even when I try to solve an engineering problem. And therefore, I've learned that this is somewhat crazy-oriented.
Somewhat what?
Crazy or schizophrenically oriented. A mathematician work...
Can I divorce
completely. Allow
Dr. Peacock to respond.
Okay.
I think I get the drift of your question. And if I do, you're misinterpreting something I said. Any form of thought takes place in the mind. Any form of creativity, imagination... all reasoning. I mean, I'm not denying the existence of the mind. The question is, what is the relation between the mind and reality when it's functioning?
The structures of mathematics are usually completely divorced from reality.
Well, so then we have a...
That's my vocation.
Let me say, if that is your view, you are placing yourself by your definition in the field of schizophrenia. But I do not regard mathematics that way.
Well,
I am an Aristotelian...
It.
Excuse me. I get to answer the questions here. You just get to ask them. I regard mathematics as being a factual science, like physics, biology, astronomy, or any other. I do not regard it as a Platonic dimension in which you play with ideas that are divorced from reality. I do not believe any mathematical concept, principle, branch, or field is divorced from reality. And therefore, I entirely reject the idea that there is such a thing as an entire subject in which you're just in another dimension and somehow you can apply it to this world and achieve practical results. I flatly reject that on philosophic grounds. So our difference rests in our view of what is mathematics. But I can only say to you that I do not equate the use of the mind with schizophrenia. I equate the use of the mind while detaching yourself from reality. And then, as far as that is concerned, if the shoe fits, wear it.
Thank you. Next question, please.
There are many other philosophies, non-Western philosophies, which actually hold primacy of consciousness and other irrational principles at its base. What is it about Kant's philosophy and Western culture that made schizophrenia so prevalent here?
Well, that is a very good question, because I think most religions in many ways preach the primacy of consciousness. And I wondered in reading this book why the primacy of consciousness, as widespread as it is, did not have greater effects of the kind you're suggesting. I don't entirely know. I think it's something to do with the conjunction of Kant on a previously very sane pro-this-world society. See, what I think the rest of the world basically has done is make a split, insofar as they're civilized at all, is make a split between their philosophy and the way they actually live. Philosophy is a ritual that they don't make any attempt to translate into their daily actual practice. Insofar as they do, they just atrophy completely. But what happened in the West is you took a society that was as close as possible to functioning on a rational basis. This is since the breakup of the medieval period, when the ancient ideas were reintroduced. You took a society that took philosophy more seriously in that sense than it had ever been taken, in that people were actually trying to live by and advance by the ideas they preached. And in the middle of that, you threw the most heinous version of mysticism and the rejection of the mind. And you created thereby an incredible split that has no precedent in any other form of society that I know of. It's that conjunction, I think, that makes, instead of us being like a hobbled society, the way the typical Oriental or non-Western or pre-rational civilization was, you took and turned it into a monster. You turned it into something that was able to function, had the means and the technology and the capacity to live by highly sophisticated abstract formulations, and then you threw the exact opposite of the truth into that mechanism. And the result was to make not just a split society, but a thoroughly diseased one that's eating itself up. That's the closest I can get, but I think it's an excellent question, and I wish I knew more Oriental history and philosophy. Let me just say that it is my intention to study the field of history, not because of this reason, but more broadly, and maybe at some point I'll give you more.
I've been studying actually Chinese history, yeah. So maybe we can talk about it sometime.
Okay. Thank you for the question. I think that's a good question.
Dr. Peikoff, I realize that you're not a psychologist, so I'll try and I'll try and ask this in a general way. Actually, just for your personal view, what do you think the glorification of madness in our society has upon social interaction and the cultural environment in terms of people being able to look at each other with respect and in terms of being able to feel they can trust other people, you know, without really knowing them, like the man on the street type situation. Do you think it has a profound effect upon the cultural atmosphere?
I think that what you call a glorification of madness, and that's a good phrase, what that has, even people who don't share it or who scoff at it, you know, the average man in the street who thinks it's all awful, still holds it in some kind of respect on the grounds that he doesn't know, but all the authorities say this is art. They all say this is great. They all put this in museums, and they teach it to the kids in school and so on. So most people, and including the best, the most decent people, have a tremendous self-doubt implanted in themselves by this kind of phenomenon. If I'm answering your question, when they see this type of thing, they think, what is the matter with me if I don't understand it? What is the matter with them if they like it? It puts a tremendous, the best way I can answer your question maybe is like this. 10 centuries from now, when they look back at our era, and they see what we took as sculpture and as painting and as music, and they see these ineffable shapes and screeches, there's going to be entire classes on what made this possible in the 20th century. It's going to be looked at exactly like you would hear about some medieval sect, you know, that would wait for the priest to start flagellating them, and they would run through the prescribed motions, ripping their hairs out, etc. And you think, it's really bizarre. You need a whole course to try to figure out how it could ever have happened. Now, at the time that it happened, they just took it as, this is the way things are. And the same thing is true of our society. We have reached, and I think that's why we are on the verge of total destruction. But just to come back to your question at the very end, I think there's a tremendous sense of distrust that everybody has of everybody as a result of the ideas and the art that are permeating the world today. There used to be, and this has been written many times, not just by objectivists, a great sense of goodwill of man toward man prior to the outbreak of World War I. And it has often been written that to those born after World War I will never know what feeling of goodwill individuals had to others who were simply strangers. The sense that we all have in common an intelligible, rational world. We can all, you know, live together, work together, and everything is, you know, they took progress as an axiom. Things are getting better and better in every way. They thought that was self-evident. World War I ended that, but not just on the political level. It ended it on all levels. And that was the time when this whole modern culture took over, and with it, the whole modern totalitarianism, communism, fascism, and now we're at the point where it's all expiring. And nobody believes in anything anymore. Communism has collapsed. Even modern art can't shock anybody. There's nothing left to shock anybody anymore. And you're at the burnt-out embers where everybody feels despair, futility, and what is left. And art has a tremendous... Art is supposed to be the inspiration of man, showing him the way... I mean, this is the objectivist view, you know, to the ideal. And instead, it's become one of the engines of alienating everyone from everyone else, engineering self-doubt, and pushing the whole world to the total disaster, which is the end of the world. And on that upbeat, I'll conclude.
Excuse me. Two very brief questions, please.
Dr. Picoff, I enjoyed your lecture. But my question is also unrelated. I was here in 1992, early in 1992, when you spoke and recommended that the members of the audience vote for President Clinton, or then candidate Clinton. Given the given reason, what you stated at the time was an imperative for change, which...
That wasn't my reason.
Well, you said that Bush must be out of office.
Yeah, that and, change. I was for one I would, change.
So... I was hoping that you could articulate...
Do I regret my recommendation?
No, I do not. I was hoping that you could articulate the objectivist principle which would morally justify a vote for a perpetrator of force.
Well, any vote for any modern candidate is a vote for a perpetrator of force. The last person you could have voted for without that problem is maybe Thomas Jefferson. Now, wait a minute. So the question becomes, to what extent in a given context are you preserving freedom or threatening it? That's how you have to judge. Every candidate is going to be for coercion 1,000 times over. But you have to judge within that context. Can you sometimes, and this is certainly true, you should just boycott all candidates. But sometimes there are cases where although both of them are disgusting, there's a strategic reason for getting rid of one of them and letting the other disgusting one take its place. And I definitely believe that, and I think last election was that. And I just to finish, because I don't want to go into politics for the rest of the night, I don't believe that if Bush had been elected, things would be any different. We had a spectacle of Republicans actually serving as an opposition for about 33 seconds, which they never would have done under Bush. So whatever tax increase he would have had would have sailed through. At least Clinton's was, you know, to some extent emasculated. Whatever socialized medicine Clinton is going to get through, Bush would have got through 3 years later. But it would have all come through. Only the worst part of it would be that that Republican ring would be entrenched forever. At least that wing has been slapped on. The country does not like the Democrats, and I said when I recommended Clinton that he would not be popular, and that he would not be able to get away with major murders, only minor ones. And I think that remains true.
It sounds pragmatic, not objective.
No, it's not pragmatic in the sense of unprincipled, because the principle has to be self-preservation. If you have a choice of someone who's going to shoot you now, and someone is going to shoot you in 10 years, and you have no other choice, but you have 9 more years to save your life. It is not pragmatism. It is self-preservation to try to buy 9 more years.
Dr. Peikoff, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dr. Peikoff.
All material in this program is protected by copyright and may not be reproduced in any form or manner, nor played before a live audience, without the express written permission of the producer, the Ayn Rand Institute. For further information or to order other products, please visit estore.ayn rand.org or call 1-800-729-6149.